Funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association. Making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, Atlantic City Mayor Marty Small denies any wrongdoing after authorities charged the mayor and his wife with abusing their teenage daughter. He's not the first Atlantic City mayor to find himself in hot water.
So if he were convicted of any of those crimes, they would rise to the level of losing his office.
Plus, ghost guns. The state looks to clamp down on 3D technology and illegal firearm trafficking.
The influx of tens of thousands of illegal weapons poses an obvious danger to the safety, stability, and security of our communities.
Also, your voice, your vote. U.S. Senate candidate Andy Kim leads in the latest poll to unseat the state's embattled senior senator, but Menendez might still have staying power even as his trial looms. And party venue crackdown. Howell farmers are fighting new restrictions that could limit their event planning.
Farmers are normally just fending for themselves. They don't have the time or the even the understanding of, you know, where they should start when they have to deal with the township.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us this Tuesday night. I'm Joanna Gagas, in for Brianna Venosi. Some shocking news out of Atlantic City. Mayor Marty Small and his wife Lakita Small are facing charges related to the alleged physical and emotional abuse of their 16-year-old daughter. Mayor Small is accused by prosecutors of beating her with a broom until she was unconscious and repeatedly punching her in the legs, along with threats of, quote, earth slamming her down the stairs before actually throwing her to the ground and threatening to smack the weave out of her head. His wife, Lakita Small, who is the superintendent of schools in Atlantic City, is accused of repeatedly beating her daughter, dragging her by her hair, and striking her with a belt. The mayor and his wife told us in a statement they're innocent of all charges and that this is not about public corruption or misconduct. But Mayor Small joins a long line of beleaguered Atlantic City leaders accused of misconduct while in office. Here to talk about this case and why Atlantic City has such a long history of corruption and complication is Micah Rasmussen, director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics at Rider University. Micah, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about this. Now, to be fair, Mayor Marty Small has not been accused of any kind of misconduct or corruption charges in his official office, but this is a complicated story nonetheless. Take a look at the fact that the principal of his daughter's school, Candace Days Chapman, is now accused of withholding charges of allegations of abuse to the state, something that she's required to do. And she ran Small's reelection campaign in 2021. How now does Mayor Small govern Atlantic City with these charges and with all of this complicated story kind of hanging over his head?
It's going to be very difficult for him until he can get resolution on this criminal trial. New Jersey law allows for the forfeiture of public office for crimes of the second or the third degree, which many of the crimes that he's charged with are crimes of the second and third degree. So if he were convicted of any of those crimes, they would rise to the level of losing his office. And so it doesn't really so much matter that it doesn't involve the office itself because of the seriousness of the crimes that are involved here.
Yeah, so some of those charges that you're talking about, aggravated assault, simple assault, making terroristic threats, also his wife is facing many of those similar charges. She is the superintendent of schools. That's another complicated layer. We'll get to that in a second. But what are we looking at in terms of, I know you're not a legal scholar here, but in terms of the timing of what a case like this could look like, a trial could look like, how long could he be governing with this hanging over his head?
Well, I don't think that we see very quick resolutions to matters that are not in municipal court, for example, right? You're talking about really, in all likelihood, the rest of the calendar year, if not next year, going into next year. And the tricky part of that for him is that he is facing potentially his reelection next year. His term is up next year. And so this could be a real factor in whether or not he runs or wins another term as mayor.
When you look at Atlantic City as a whole, I mean, he's one of many in this long line, right, of beleaguered leaders, of corruption charges or misconduct charges that have come down the line. What is it about this city in particular that makes it so ripe for corruption, for misconduct?
Well, the city's scandal problems, political scandal problems, date to the beginning of legalized gambling in Atlantic City. And what I think you can say about the five mayors who have been who have faced criminal charges while in office since gambling was legalized in 1978, you can say that some of them were for public corruption, some of them were involving corruption of public office, some of them were more personal in nature. One mayor, the last mayor who was indicted, it was about personal embezzlement of funds of a youth basketball team that he had founded. The mayor before that got into trouble, it was over falsifying military accomplishments that he had earned. So, you know, it's not always the public corruption charges, but it doesn't make it any less serious.
And let's just quickly talk about Lakeeta Smalls, his wife, who is the superintendent of schools. What could happen now to her position, to Principal Daze Chapman?
Right. So I think that they have less protection than the mayor has, according to the law. Council, for example, can't remove the mayor unless it's like involving attendance. But the superintendent, the principal, they don't have those same protections. They have due process rights, but they don't have the rights to conduct themselves with impunity. So I think you can expect to see charges. Of course, it depends on the willingness of the school board members to move on those members, on those employees. And so it remains to be seen what kind of political will there is on the school board, but it's going to be tough for them to ignore charges of this nature involving a student.
Mike Erasmussen, director of the Rebovich Institute at Rider University, thank you for the insight.
Thanks, Joanna.
In the battle to get illegal guns off the street, ghost guns are some of the hardest to track. And technology might actually be making it worse. Senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan attended a hearing today to learn how 3D printing of guns, along with gun parts sold on the black market, are wreaking havoc on our communities.
Investigators played audio of multiple shots fired in Trenton, a so-called numerous discharge event they claim is part of a rising statewide threat posed by easily obtained ghost guns. Whether assembled from kits or created out of plastic by 3D printers, the weapons are cheap, easy to get, and used repeatedly in multiple crimes, agents testified in a statehouse hearing.
Ghost guns were associated with violent crimes such as shootings, armed robberies, as well as incidents of domestic violence and road rage. Ghost guns were also recovered along with high-capacity magazines.
A panel of experts told New Jersey State Commission of Investigation police went from recovering one ghost gun a week in 2019 to one per day last year. The guns lack serial numbers but can be traced by their bullet casings. Detectives discovered individual weapons like this popular Polymer 80 ghost gun were often used in multiple crimes in a single neighborhood.
This slide indicates five shootings occurred over a four-month period within the city of Trenton. The first two shootings were at the same location days apart. There were 11 victims. Two were killed. The weapon recovered was recovered during a search warrant.
Investigators identified just 21 guns used in 159 shootings all across New Jersey. They say organized crime buys gun parts in bulk to maximize profits, but that computer codes to print ghost guns are easy to download. One undercover witness testified.
Any idiot can put together the Polymer 80s. With this plastic gun, it's like putting together IKEA furniture. It comes with a blueprint. It comes with a little jig to do it. And you know what? You don't have to be mechanically inclined to do it. You drill a couple holes, cut the plastic, and within a couple hours, somebody has a gun.
The internet also offers black market switches, a small plastic piece that, when inserted into a regular firearm, transforms it into an automatic weapon, often accompanied by plastic extended magazines.
The more bullets that are fired in an incident, the more likely that gunfire kills someone, hits bystanders, or causes additional damage.
Switches were available for sale on popular video sharing websites and China-based commerce websites. Both options appear to ship directly to any requested address. These devices compromise weapons, making them less reliable, less accurate, and more dangerous to bystanders and the general public. There is no legitimate reason that a law-abiding citizen would possess a switch.
Like all ghost gun parts, switches are easy to print, and experts testified the technology is outstripping statutes.
The influx of tens of thousands of illegal weapons poses an obvious danger to the safety, stability, and security of our communities. What may be less obvious is how much havoc even one or two of these guns can wreak in a community.
Experts testified New Jersey needs regulatory reforms and stronger statutes to address ghost guns, switches, and gun violence. The SCI will issue a report with recommendations in a few months. At the Statehouse Annex in Trenton, I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
Andy Kim has a significant lead over both of his Republican challengers for U.S. Senate in a new poll released by Fairleigh Dickinson University. The poll puts Kim around 9 percentage points higher than either of his Republican challengers, Mendham Borough Mayor Christine Serrano-Glassner and real estate developer Curtis Bashaw. But those numbers are without the embattled U.S. Senator Bob Menendez in the mix. Add him in, and this race gets much more interesting. Menendez has until early June to declare a run as an independent, and if he does, well, poll numbers show he cuts Kim's lead in half. That Menendez base tends to be Hispanic and black voters who right now are undecided on who they'll vote for if Menendez is not in the race. So what is the latest with the Menendez court battle? Senior political correspondent David Cruz has our update.
Late last year, in an effort to explain almost $500,000 in cash, prosecutors say they found in his home, in shoeboxes and duffel bags and suit jacket pockets, Senator Bob Menendez told a story that was hard for many to understand, much less believe.
I have drawn from my personal credit union savings account for the better part of 30 years, $400 every week in cash. And while that may seem old-fashioned, or some people may think of it as crazy, the reality is that the government has those records. They have the accounts that show that, and they chose not to use it.
Supposedly, fear of government confiscation was the motivation there. But in response to a defense motion to squash the money evidence, prosecutors said on Friday that some of that cash was wrapped in $10,000 bands from a bank where neither Menendez nor his wife had an account.
A lot of the motions that have been filed by the defense are called motions in limine, which are done in advance of trial. And of course, the defense attorneys are trying to basically exclude as much as possible that's introduced before the jury. So in response to the government's coming back saying, wait a minute, that's not the right way to go. This is a fact dispute, and it's relevant for the jury to consider.
Former prosecutor Chris Grammaccioni said the senator's defense team has so far unsuccessfully tried to keep damaging evidence away from an eventual jury, even as the news of the motions allows that same evidence to seep into their minds.
It's things like excluding a lavish lifestyle by some of the co-conspirators, excluding the fact that that the co-conspirators were not registered as foreign agents under the FARA Act. And in terms of Senator and Mrs. Menendez, or Senator Menendez, he's trying to exclude evidence like the gold bars and the cash on the basis that it's speculative evidence. And you know, that's, in my personal opinion, I don't think that's going to carry any water.
One motion that did get the courts okay was the motion to delay until July Nadine Menendez's case, as she deals with some undisclosed medical issues. But yesterday, it was prosecutors who moved for a delay of the senator's trial, citing conflicts with the representation of some of the other co-defendants. But the defense says they're actually ready to go next month. That's a flip-flop on the part of both sides. So What could it mean for the senator's future?
I don't think he's always been a very realistic politician, right? He didn't get where he is with flights of fancy. He's got to know that that's not really in the cards for him. His Senate career is coming to an end. His political career is coming to an end. My guess, my strong suspicion would be that his goal here has to be to get himself out of as much legal trouble as he possibly can, right? I mean, that would be the kind of deal that I would think he would be looking for.
Most experts assume more motions are likely in this case as prosecutors keep the pressure on and the defense looks for safety valves to relieve it. Meanwhile, the state's political establishment continues to shake politically from the upheaval the case is causing. I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
As legislators hammer out the details of how to fund our schools next year, voters in Toms River and Seaside Heights are taking the matter into their own hands. A vote is being held today to decide whether the two districts should merge. And if they do, it could bring millions of dollars in state aid back to Toms River that's been on the losing end of the school funding formula for years now. But not everyone is on board with the move. Ted Goldberg is in Toms River to hear from education leaders and community members as they cast their votes.
Depending on how today's election goes in five shore towns, Seaside Heights could lose its only school, Hugh J. Boyd Elementary.
All in all, it's a win-win situation for our taxpayers and the community.
I think it's a travesty.
A regionalization plan is on the ballot, which could push Seaside Heights into the Toms River School District. Suzanne Hagen and Sherry Ensor teach at Hugh J. Boyd and are co-presidents for the teachers union there.
It's a landmark. It has been here for years. It provides so many services for our students that we fear they may not get over the bridge.
If the referendum passes, Boyd Elementary would stay open for just five more years, or until enrollment drops below 125 students.
7 or 8 years ago, we had approximately a high 200 figure, near the 300 mark. We're down to 184 students.
Seaside Mayor Anthony Vaz used to be superintendent of schools in Spotswood. He says a merger would be a big boost for local students.
They'll have a diverse curriculum, which will be pre-K to 8, 8 to 12, in a district that has a straightforward curriculum. Right now, our kids stay to 6th grade. They go to Central with other surrounding towns. The curriculum we have is not equal.
Toms River is sending us to Eastover, supposedly, and our test scores are much higher than theirs. So it kind of just proves the fact that we're getting sent over the bridge for a better education when the school they're sending us to has lower test scores than we do.
We're all digging out of post-COVID, and certainly our funding issues over the last years have an impact on Toms River scores completely. But Eastover, is not a school who needs a TSI, who needs improvement. I know that Hugh J. Boyd scores have come out of TSI.
TSI refers to a state program for underperforming schools. Toms River Superintendent Michael Sitta doesn't deny that Boyd Elementary students have higher test scores than where they would go. But he says bringing more students to Toms River brings more state resources.
In Toms River, it's going to bring about $35 to $40 million over the next 10 years in tax levy revenue that comes from Seaside Heights that will benefit all the children.
Hagen is skeptical that Seaside's taxpayers will benefit long term.
If you ask any community that started sharing services with another school district and they go, it comes to equalized taxes, you wind up paying far more in the end, especially when you go to a community that pays 51%.
While Ensor is afraid that longer travel times for Seaside students mean they won't participate in as many activities as their Toms River classmates.
We fear our students may not be able to participate in the after-school activities, PTA functions, concerts, programs, and clubs because there is no transportation to and from.
Transportation will be consistent as part of our regional school district. Everything that we have and we do for our children here, they become an extension of our family.
Seaside students currently go to Central Regional for middle and high school in Ocean County. Doug Corbett is their acting superintendent, and he tells us if the referendum passes, quote, the Central Regional School District will be left with a $3 million hole in its budget. Our community should not be on the hook to assist neighboring towns and school districts who should really be looking at other options and long-term plans to better manage their funds and provide for their own constituents. For this plan to move forward, voters in Toms River and Seaside Heights must approve it. In Ocean County, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
In our Spotlight on Business report, farmers in New Jersey were thrilled last year when Governor Murphy signed a law allowing them to host events on their farms, like weddings, raising much-needed revenue. But farmers in Howell Township might face a whole new set of restrictions on those events if a new ordinance passes requiring them to pay for expensive permits. Raven Santana visited a few of those farms to hear their concerns.
Our feed bill here every month is just around $4,000. Farrier could be about $800. Teeth is another $1,200 to $1,500.
It's been an expensive year for Stephanie Gluck. She owns just under 14 acres of land on her farm, Magnolia, which rescues several different types of animals, including horses.
They really need a lot of care. So when we get them initially, it does cost a lot of money.
Which is why she was excited to take advantage of a bill Governor Murphy signed last year that would allow farms to hold special events. Under the bill, a preserved farm that produces agricultural or horticultural products worth more than $10,000 annually may hold up to a maximum of 26 special occasion events per calendar year, of which six may have 250 guests or more in attendance.
So we're always looking for people to either sponsor a horse, host fundraisers to raise the money to help these horses.
She was hoping to use the farm to host large fundraisers, but she says that changed when Howell Township proposed an ordinance that would regulate special events on farms. The township's proposal would require events with more than 30 people to obtain a potentially costly site plan approval with detailed parking, stormwater runoff, and food handling measures.
What keeps me up at night is, God forbid, that there's an accident on a farm or an event that I approved.
Matthew Howard is the Director of Community Development and Land Use for Howell Township. Howard says the process has been tedious as they have to take into account all parties involved.
Municipal land use law tasks us, the township, with certain things. There's competing interests, for example. There are businesses that are doing this activity that have gone through the approval process. We want to be fair to them as well. There's also paramount, first and foremost, is health and safety. Again, farms were never built to be a banquet hall. We want to make sure as the public is going to this property, where maybe they never have before, there's things like ingress and egress, the utilities are worked out, the facilities where the bathrooms are, where the food is coming from. We want to make sure it's safe for the property owner, for the people visiting the site, and then we also have a responsibility to all the taxpayers of Howell Township.
Stop all these permit fees. It's extremely expensive.
Gluck's sentiments echo the struggles of sisters Juliana Ordunia and Norma Alcaraz. The two co-own the Garden Gift Shop located on this 14-acre farm in Howell Township, where they produce honey, flowers, and vegetables.
We don't have mortgage, but we do have taxes. You know, we have all the utility bills. And not just that, you know, all the supplies that we need to, you know, to fill our jar. And so it was a struggle. We did close, but we were doing roadside pickups.
Yeah. We did a couple deliveries for our elderly customers because they were afraid to leave their home.
They bought the farm 5 years ago, but when COVID hit, they say they were forced to pivot to stay afloat and have been struggling ever since. They're now concerned the new restrictions could impact their livelihood. The sisters say they have been hosting 20 to 25 vendors for events, sometimes bringing in 500 people.
To have a big barn and to bring in 30 people, it's nonsense.
Members of the Farmers Advisory Committee argue that farmers have been left out of the process and stress why their suggestions are important.
Farmers are normally just fending for themselves. They don't have the time or the even the understanding of, you know, where they should start when they have to deal with the township, with legislation, with Trenton.
Howard says the council is working tirelessly to make sure the proposal is fair to everyone. He expects by late April, early May, the ordinance will be introduced and the town will hold a public meeting. He says he's now optimistic it will be approved by the end of May. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Raven Santana.
It's a peanut butter and jelly flavored pot brownie. That's the first cannabis-infused food item to be sold in New Jersey. The brownie is the homemade product of a Jersey City company called Butta Cake, a black women-owned business that's the first one approved to sell edible products in the state. Owners Mata Figaro and Yasmin Obi first started selling peach-flavored dissolvable oral strips in December of last year and are now ready to bring their peanut butter and jelly pot brownie to at least 10 dispensaries around the state. The timing is interesting because the Cannabis Regulatory Commission hasn't yet rolled out statewide regulations for a broader edible market that could eventually include candies, drinks, and other cannabis goodies. But they have approved waivers for Butta Cake to sell these two products. As for the Jersey City bakers, well, their entry into the marketplace could open up national distribution for their brownie.
And for some reason, they just never allowed edibles, and specifically not brownies. And so for mine to be the first one, this is a really big feat. We've been, you know, going back and forth and pleading our case to the CRC and the powers that be. And for our brownie to be the first one to launch in the legal market in New Jersey is just incredible accomplishment. It's just two of us girls from Jersey whipping them away. And with the help of our colleagues in the industry, and especially at Columbia Care, we get all of these brownies packaged up and sent to the stores.
And on Wall Street today, the market's reacting to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell saying interest rates need to remain higher longer. Here's a look at how they closed. That does it for us tonight. But before you go, don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Joanna Gagas for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com and by the PSCG Foundation.
Have some water.
Sir. Look at these kids.
How are you?
What do you see? I see myself. I became an ESL teacher to give my students what I wanted when I came to this country. The opportunity to learn, to dream, to achieve. A chance to belong and to be an American. My name is Julia Toriani Crompton, and I'm proud to be an NJEA member.